Blog Talk Radio.
Women have the power to transform this world. We can end crime and violence if we all agree to do one thing, share. Let's share our wisdom, share our time, share our talents, share our finances, but most of all, let's share our love. This is the Female Solution. Join me, Naima Latif, every morning, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central Standard Time, as we bring you stimulating discussions about the issues affecting our lives. If you're listening online at www.blogtalkradio.com/the-female-solution, press the blue button that says follow and get our daily topics every morning directly to your email and your smartphone.
Hi, I'm Naima Latif, executive producer of the Female Solution Radio Show. We invite you to call in 515-605-9325 and participate in this daily think tank as we examine the challenges we face and develop solutions that restore peace and harmony. We are global transformers, changing the world from the way it is to the way it should be. We are one. Wherever we live on this earth, we are one human family. On behalf of our team of radio hosts, I'd like to extend a greeting to all the members of our family, whenever and wherever you may be listening around the world. To our family in China, Ni Hao. In India, Namaste. In Japan, Konnichiwa. In Korea, Annyeonghaseyo. In Russia, Zdravstvuyte. In Germany, Guten Tag. In Poland, Dzień dobry. In France, Bonjour. In Spain, Hola. In Italy, Ciao. In Egypt, Ahlan wa sahlan. In Ghana, Akwaaba. In Nigeria, Peleo. In South Africa, Sawubona. In Senegal, Nangadef. In Kenya, Jambo. In Israel, Shalom. In Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia, Assalamu alaikum. Greetings, and may peace be upon you all.
Greetings, everyone.
We have an opportunity to transform the whole global society in the next 50 years. 50 years from now, the earth will be populated by a new generation of adults, many of whom are yet unborn. Our mission is to nurture them in childhood with love, guidance, and protection, and to raise them in healthy, happy families. If we impart values of compassion, generosity, and respect for fellow human beings in the next generation of children, they will create a world where people can live together in peace. This is our goal. Be a part of the transformation. Get your copy of the book, The Female Solution. Go to www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com.
Greetings, everybody. This is Jana, author of Success Strategies for Black People and host of the annual Blogging Carnival for Nonviolence. Welcome, everybody, to the August 2021 edition of Success Strategies with Jana. Happy August, everyone. Today, we're returning to the question, how can we create a peaceful world? And if you listen to the show regularly, you know that we've been talking about this topic for over a year now from lots of different angles, lots of different, angles, different parts of the world, different people, different voices, different opinions. So happy August. My guest today is Lama Rangdro, one of the few Black African-American Tibetan Lamas. If you'd like to talk to my guest or to me, please phone us on 515-605-9325. Or alternatively, you can join us on Facebook Live at The Female Solution. Welcome, Lama Rangdro. Welcome to my show. Okay, are you there? Are you there? Well, okay, you're showing on my board, but I don't know if
you're
taking
yes.
a little. Oh, yeah, there you go.
I'm here.
Okay, hi. Hi, welcome to my show.
Oh, gosh, I'm really feeling privileged to spend some time with you this morning across the globe. but tell me, am I clear? Am I loud enough? I just want to make sure there's no sound problems before we get started.
Oh, great. I think you could be a little bit louder.
Okay, hold on. Let me try my speakerphone. Is that any better?
I wouldn't have said so. Not really. It's
not
okay.
really?
You're very, very clear.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll stay with the speakerphone. It might be a little bit more clear than my having my earpods in. So, yes,
okay.
I'm feeling very privileged and happy that we met years ago and that I remained in your mind all of this time.
Yeah, well, I'm very, very happy that you've joined us. As I said, we're talking about how can we create a peaceful world, which we've talked about a lot on this show. And being a Buddhist, I believe that you are committed to peace and nonviolence. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, great. You produced a short film some years ago entitled Festival Cancelled Due to Heavy Rain, in which you talk
mm-hmm.
about your thoughts when you went on a pilgrimage to Cambodia.
Yes.
Cambodia is a traditionally Buddhist country which was heavily bombed by the U.S. during the Vietnam War, as we all know, and as you talked about this in your book, in your film, rather. Festival Cancelled Due to Heavy Rain.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about your experience of growing up in the hood during the Vietnam War?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a rather dark period in my life. My wonder years, my childhood, and my formative years as a human personality, you know, I was born during Jim Crow. In the early 50s. And so as a result then, you know, my family has been in America for 250 years.
Mm-hmm.
We are not new to the situation. And I know this because our family name goes back to slavery, and we had a famous relative who escaped from slavery and went on to study at Yale University during slavery, but he not allowed to be in the class. He had to stand outside in the hallway or outside the window. But he stayed there hiding for 4 years studying, and then when he finished, they wouldn't grant him a degree because, of course, blacks didn't receive degrees at that time. Yeah, and so. They did confer a certificate because he was in the Department of Divinity. So they gave him a certificate of to preach. And he changed his name. But by that time, he was literate. And he wrote actually two books. And so we know quite a bit about him.
And what was his name?
His name was James Pembroke, by birth.
Okay.
And and so my mother's last name is Pembroke, maiden name, and my grandmother's name is Pembroke, and so our name goes all the way back to those centuries. And he wrote a detailed book about what it was like to escape, the fears and trepidations.
Mm.
He was taken in by a Quaker family who taught him how to read and write and kind of helped
mm-hmm.
him to secret himself at Yale. And and all this time they were putting out the slave catcher notices, you know. His owner wanted him back badly.
Sure.
And so, you know, we were just kind of talking about this idea of being pursued. And so I have this family memory of being pursued for the last 250 years. And, of course, that puts us in participating with the Civil War and the First World War and the Second World War and the Korean conflict. And my father went off to war, and he returned with PTSD, and the VA picked him up one day. He never came home. So I never had a father as a result of this war. I'm giving you this kind of lead up because you got to know this background that I was exposed to understand what it was like from my viewpoint being in the 60s watching the Vietnam War. So it was a very difficult time. There was a lot of racial tension, obviously. And I felt that very viscerally because I lived in an all-white community. They had a special deal on houses my mom took advantage of, which was no money down, $60 a month for a three-bedroom. And so, but the thing was, we were nestled in the white community, and so the kids beat me up. After school, I was in the third grade.
Really? Wow.
And so my mother went to the school and said, what can we do about this? And the principal told her, she said to me, that if I don't like being beat up every day, that we should move. And that was his solution. And
well,
so,
the principal.
Right. This is all white. The school's white, teacher's white, student's white, my bully's white, principal white, everybody was white. And I was in the L.A. area. And so eventually there was a big transition in our neighborhoods turned black because of the Watts riots. We had a lot of people exiting the inner city, and they came out to our community, and, of course, that created what they call white flight, meaning so many black people moved in that the whites. So and of course they were fighting all the time, bringing the inner city black issues into the suburbs and the white issues from us. So that was
what happened. When was it, 69?
This began in 60. Let's see, we moved to actually Compton first, so that was about 61. And then around 63, we moved into this house, and I was there for 17 years. So I was there from 63, I went to college in 71. So 63 to 71, all of this was happening when I was at home. But, there were the inner city also befell us, too. So, I mean, there was a lot of escalation and violence.
Yeah,
and just tension all around, and with that everyday background, of course, I lived through JFK's assassination.
Yes,
his brother's assassination.
Yeah,
Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, Malcolm X's assassination. This was all on television, right?
Yeah, I remember. Those days. Yeah.
And also the funerals, the world stopped for the funerals, and little John and all this, and in addition to all of that, then there's the war.
It's like there was a war in Vietnam, and there was also a war happening at home at the same time.
Yes, and. So true, some people ask me in my later years, well, how come you didn't join the military? I said, I was engaged in the war on the streets.
to
a foreign country that hadn't done anything to me. We were in a close-knit community. I was there 17 years, so we knew all the families and they knew us, and so some of the young men were excited about going to fight, and they joined the Army, Navy, Marines, and so forth, and they got married before they left. And so I remember seeing them in their front yards in the wedding parties with the uniforms,
Right.
And it was somewhat of a festive time because, people were proud to defend the country. But
right.
then, you know, the story we were getting on the news was all hell was breaking loose
yes.
over there.
Yes.
And then, you know, the brothers came back because it was mostly men, and
mm-hmm.
they were all PTSD. So
yeah,
they brought the war
that.
Back to the community, you know, fighting
yeah.
with their spouses and families breaking up and shooting, you know, people. And I mean, it's just really, you know, the Vietnam War was only a part of a much larger scenario being
mm-hmm.
in L.A. At the neighborhood level, at the community level, racially, just the tragedy of the public assassinations, riots
yeah,
in major
yeah.
cities, you know, the wedding, the joy of wedding and the agony
mm.
of,
mm.
you know, the we used to call it the white car. There was a white car that used to run, drive around the neighborhood. And my mm. uncle was living with us because my eldest cousin, his son, was over in Nam. And
right.
my uncle was living
right.
with us to save money because he wanted to buy a house for his son when he returned. So this
yeah.
white car drives through the neighborhood, you know, maybe once or twice a week, and it's got two
mm.
military men in it, and they're the ones that deliver
mm.
the messages to the family that,
yeah.
You know, so-and-so will not be coming home, died in action. And it was always, you know, you see the white car, and you just hold your breath, and you kind of peek out the window
yeah.
and see what house they're going to.
Yeah.
And one day it came to ours. And my cousin had died, and I watched his father disintegrate as a human being.
Mm.
And you know, he just took it very badly. He became an alcoholic and
yeah.
had all kinds of trouble. Just so you know, it was in our, the Vietnam War was in our house. Okay?
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
the brokenness and the thanklessness of it, other than the men showing up that day, and just devastation everywhere. So what it was like in the hood during that time is all of this is going on while
mm.
what became the Iran-Contra affair in America. There were forces that were bringing drugs into our community
yeah.
at this time.
Yeah.
And, I mean, at first it started off with pharmaceutical drugs, which we don't have a pharmaceutical plant in our neighborhood. And so it
yeah,
was very strange. But it was,
on the street.
You know, it was large amounts. Then
mm.
it became, you know, kind of like LSD, mescaline, things that were mind-altering and hallucinogens. Right. Then those
and
came.
Heroin.
Then marijuana came. Not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Marijuana came.
Not yet.
Then
okay.
angel dust, the stuff they
oh, yeah.
put on it. Right. And then finally the heroin came.
Really?
And
wow.
the hash. And then I even saw raw opium, right, coming from Afghanistan
really?
in our neighborhood. And
really?
So, you know, yeah, this. I mean, you know, this was the mix that you was supposed
so,
to take you
none
out.
None of your friends and neighbors owned planes, right?
No.
You didn't own a plane, and none
no,
of your friends
matter,
and neighbors owned
no, these
planes.
Were,
so
they,
you were
they,
not the people
they,
who were bringing this stuff in, right?
No, there were people coming from all over the world, popping up
mm.
with suitcases and trucks full of drugs, and
yeah.
And we were shocked. I mean, you know, you. Going around in your neighborhood, and one day they find a truck, and it's got, you know, 1,500 pounds of marijuana. You think, well, what is that about? So
yeah.
it was. I'm just giving you a tone for the gauntlet of circumstance that
sure.
often not represented in its totality. You know, there are stories about. Various at the drug aspect, the war aspect, the racial strife, the riots, but
yeah.
when living in it, you were living in a cauldron where all of those forces were being brought to bear on me as a young teenage black man. And it got so terrible. I graduated from school early. I left. We had to, usually you have to have 12 years. I left at 11 to get out of there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
and I went to college.
Eager to get out, get to somewhere better.
Yeah.
I'm just going to stop you there.
So,
I want to hear more of your story, but we've got some callers on the line, so I'm just going to see who's on the line.
Okay.
Hi, this is Jana. Welcome to Success Strategies. I'm speaking with Lama Rendral today. Who's calling, please? Who's calling? We've got area code 779. Hi, are you there?
I'm just a listener.
Okay, you hang on. Hi, who's there?
I'm just a listener.
You're just a listener. Can you tell us your name, please, listener?
Hashim Kamau.
Okay, welcome to the show. I'm just going to put you on hold, but you're very welcome to make some comments if you want to, ask questions. And I'll give you another space to do that in case you want to, okay?
Thank you.
Let's see who else is on the line. Hi, greetings, it's Jana. Welcome to my show. Who's calling, please? Area code 425.
Hi, this is Selma.
Hi, Selma. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Have you heard what Lama Rangel's just been sharing about growing up in the hood in California during the war?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Okay. Have you got any comments or observations? What did you think about what he said?
You know, it's just such a depth of humanity. It's just really amazing. I take it all to heart.
Oh.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is. It's a pretty amazing story. It really is. And so many young guys are going through the same thing at the same time. I'm just going to see who else we've got here. Greetings. Good afternoon, caller. Area code 863. Who's calling, please? I can't really hear you. Your volume is a little bit low. Can you turn it up a little bit?
Jana, are you able to hear me?
I can hear you. I put my speakerphone on. I can hear you now, yeah.
Okay, yeah, this is Naima. I think 863.
Hey, Naima.
I think they weren't ready to speak yet. But I did have a question for your guest. And, of course, we're on Facebook Live on the Female Solution Facebook page. And the Viada from Florida sends her greetings. And Zelda from Chicago says, Grand Ryan, Dean Sister. And Viada says, Grand Afternoon. And I certainly send my greetings to welcome
Viada.
I have a question.
Great. What's your question for Lama Rendral?
Yes, I have a question for Lama Langer, Lama Rangel. He mentioned that his family name is Pembroke, and we have a township here in Illinois named after Pembroke. I don't know where the name came from. I don't know if that's maybe some of his relatives, but it's a farming town in Pembroke. Matter of fact, one of our previous hosts, she now lives there in the farming community and will be going out there and doing farming activities and conducting a farming program with her. So I was wondering if that is perhaps some connection to his relatives. They spell it P-E-M-B-R-O-K-E, and it's spelled Pembroke. Does that sound like that might be your people?
that's the same spelling as our family name. We know that we were enslaved in the North, actually, in the state of Maryland. We came through Boston Harbor. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that the North was very involved in the slave trade. Of course, the North won the war, so according to them, the South were the bad guys. But the North was very involved in slave work.
Yeah, it just ended sooner
in the
north. It was outlawed in the north when it was still going on in the south. But yeah, we're finding more and more evidence, aren't we, of slavery in the north?
That's not true. No, they had slave farms, and what a slave farm was instead of growing tobacco or cotton, they grew slaves. And they cultivated various kinds of slaves to work hard labor in the fields, but also the women's story is equally kind of macabre in that they mixed races to create a light-skinned black female, and then they would teach her how to sing and play music, and then she would be sold to the South for sex work among the wealthy class. And
okay.
There were communities of
mulattoes. I've heard of that kind of thing happening in New Orleans. I've not heard of it happening in the North.
No. Yes, I'm correcting the record. It also happened in the North. And that's where the phrase being sold down the river comes from, because they would take them over to the Mississippi River and take them down to sell. And plus, if any slave tried to escape, then his or her whole family was sent for hard labor in the South. And so
okay.
This is all in the book.
God, that's awful. That's horrible.
And
it reminds me of things
book.
That happened in that film, 12 Years a Slave, where the guy was kidnapped and sent down South. And that happened a lot. We don't hear about it very much, but it happened a lot.
Yeah.
Even in states where slavery had been abolished, that they would come and they would kidnap free black people and sell them into slavery.
And
it happened
so this
more
was
than
an institutional kind of farming operation. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
It wasn't about being free. It was a farming operation. It just the produce was humans for labor.
Yeah, exactly. And what they did in the Caribbean, because basically slavery being abolished, I think there was like 20 years before it was. Before that would come into effect. So that's when they started having slave farms in the Caribbean as well, when the planters said, we're going to lose all this workforce, so we need to build up the workforce. So they started having slave farms. I don't know if you've seen that film, Goodbye, Uncle Tom.
Oh, I've seen that. Oh, that'll upset you. Yes, I've seen it.
I've just seen this clip, which is a slave farm. I've never seen anything about a slave farm before. I'd read about them, but I'd never seen one, where they had the women in a barn. I mean, the women were literally livestock. They had the ones that were pregnant and the ones that had just given birth were kept in a barn. Right, and the planter was saying, every time one of them gives birth, I give her a gold coin. Every time she pushes out a pup. So he was referring to newborn black people as pups.
Woo!
Yeah, it's very upsetting, very disturbing to watch.
Well, you know, on a positive note, this ancestor, James Pembroke, and he changed his name to Pennington, P-E-N-N-I-N-G-T-O-N, Pennington.
Okay.
And he's known historically as James Pembroke Pennington. He became an abolitionist. He went under this assumed name of James Pennington, and he pastored a church in New York City. And was very involved in. He had a station for the Underground Railroad.
And where was that? Where was his station?
At his church that he pastored in New York City. And again, all in his book. He wrote all about this. But furthering that. He also was a fundraiser, and he raised the money for the legal counsel for the Amistad group.
Oh, really?
And,
wow. You see, now you didn't cover that in the film. I think it's a great film that Steven Spielberg has made about Amistad, but he did not mention that in the film.
No. And also, James Pembroke Pennington did the kind of the benediction before they got on a ship to return back to Africa. So he was a very prolific abolitionist, so much so that, and you have to think about the time, Harriet Beecher Stowe was a prominent abolitionist, and she wrote praises of him in Uncle Tom's Cabin. Yeah, she said he was the most prominent abolitionist of the era. And so,
really? Wow. You know, okay, I want to come back to you about that, but we're just going to have a break, just a quick break.
Okay.
We'll be right back. And for those who want to speak to our guest, call in 515-605-9325. Press 1 when you're ready to speak. That'll light your number up on our switchboard. And our host, Jana, live from London, will open your mic and get your thoughts. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Do you want to live in a world without war? Join our global peace movement. Heavenly Culture World Peace Restoration of Light transcends culture, religion, ideology, and other boundaries to achieve peaceful harmony in the global society. HWPL is committed to bringing world peace and cessation of war through peaceful dialogue between religious groups. I am Director Shin-Suk Kim of the HWPL Chicago Branch of North America. Join us for our next gathering. Call 773-580-1501 and be a part of the movement for world peace. Email us at chicagohwpl@gmail.com.
Everything you need, what your body needs, is found in nature. So Susan Essentials doesn't do it any other way. Susan Essentials provides your employees and individuals access to over 20,000 nutritional products, and they are shipped direct to your door. Because Susan Essentials is certified in plant-based healing, we're permitted to offer you the best nutritional supplements on the planet. They're non-GMO and sustainably produced. And we take the guesswork out for you. Let Susan Essentials help you take control of your health today.
Hi, I'm Naima Latif, executive producer of the Female Solution Global Radio TV show. We are a part of the online network of Associated Internet Radio hosts, On Air. On Air empowers you with transformative news and interactive radio TV shows. This is such a wonderful time to be alive and to see our human family coming together as one community as a result of that powerful tool, the Internet. We can now talk directly to each other all over the world. There's no need for conflict or misunderstanding. There's no need for violence to solve our differences. We can talk to each other face to face until we reach an agreement. On Air offers a fantastic global guide to communicators from all over the world who are using their Internet platforms to inspire us to strive to be our best selves in order to become the kind, compassionate, loving people we were all born to be. Once we do that, we'll see planet Earth transformed into a place of peace. Subscribe to the recommended YouTube channels, Facebook pages, and podcasts created by these Voices of Enlightenment. On Air provides daily news briefs and a weekly magazine to keep you abreast of events and opportunities. On Air news affiliates in television, radio, and print share information, insight, and interviews with notable personalities. Go to onaireverywhere.com for a daily dose of uplifting news. We're on air everywhere, online all the time.
And we're back. This is Jana. Welcome to my show, Success Strategies. I'm speaking with my guest today, Lama Rangel, who's telling us some fascinating information about himself, his own life, and his family history. If you'd like to speak to Lama Rangel or to me, please call in on 515-605-9325. And if you're outside of the United States, you need to put 001 in front of that. So it's 001-515-605-9325. We've got another caller on the line. I'm just going to see who's on the line. Hi, welcome to my show. This is Jana speaking, area code 779. Thanks for joining us.
This is Hashim again.
Hi.
I talked to you earlier. You put me on hold.
Oh, okay. You're back. Sorry. I'm sorry about that. I wasn't trying to put the phone down. I just thought you might need a little bit of time and space. Did you want to ask a question or make a statement, or are you still just in listening mode?
I'm in listening mode, but I'm enjoying the show. You've given me very much insight in the past. I thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate you, and we really appreciate you listening. And anybody who wants to ask a question, I'll give more space for that later on. I would like to hear some more about this story, Lama Rangel, because I don't know if you knew, but there were actually black abolitionists in Britain as well, back in the 17th century onwards. There were black abolitionists in Britain, and some of them owned businesses. Some of them were newspaper owners, and they also raised money for the abolitionist movement.
Yes,
are you aware of that?
I am aware. I know that I am aware, and I know that their actions and their activity actually both inspired abolition and encouraged abolition in the Americas. But
Frederick Douglass actually came to Britain at least once and did a book tour here in Britain, and that added some fire to the abolitionist flame here in Britain.
Adding some more history to James Pembroke Pennington. Pembroke Pennington was also the minister who married Frederick Douglass to his first wife.
Oh,
wow!
Really? Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So, was he married here in Britain? Really, I had no idea.
He was married twice. His first wife died, but James Pembroke Pennington did the proceedings for that wedding. And at one point, much to the astonishment of his colleagues at the time, he boarded a ship twice and went to Europe and actually spoke in the abolitionist community in London.
Really? Wow. That's amazing. Yeah, I know he was very popular. I know that Frederick Douglass was a very popular speaker here in Britain, but I didn't realize, I've never heard about James Pennington until just now. But
it's all
what I find with black history, there's always more to learn.
I'll tell you why you've never heard of him, because there's quite a backstory. His first book was an autobiography called The Fugitive Blacksmith. But his second was kind of a history of black people told from his point of view. and he spends a lot of time. I wrote about this in a publication that was published in India, actually. But in his second book, he wrote about the Bible because he was a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And he specifically addressed the curse of Ham.
Okay.
Now, as you know, Ham was the son of Noah. And as the story goes, Ham offended his father, and as a result, Noah, according to some historians, cursed Ham. His curse was that all of his children will have dark skin. And the curse
I don't actually remember reading that. I know people say that, But my recollection of what it says is very different from that. But you carry on.
Yeah. Well, I'm just telling you what James Pembroke's discourse in his book was.
Okay.
He, remember, he's writing during slavery.
Okay.
So he's confronting this notion that is popular in his time, in his place. And so he says...
Right, and it's still popular now.
That,
I don't agree with it, but it is popular now still.
He, in his book, he makes this point that, number one, who was Noah to curse Ham? Because only God could curse people. That was one.
Okay.
And two, he said, how could Ham possibly be cursed for the small infraction of pride that he injured of his father when the whole
right.
slavery throughout the world is not cursed? And so that was his principal argument. And it has not gone down well as a memorable thing to enter into the American lexicon of slaves didn't know how to read except for a few. Now, Frederick Douglass was more, he navigated the discomfort of the slave community, enslaving
mm-hmm.
community, with a little bit more
mm-hmm.
sophistication. He wasn't so blunt, and so he was allowed to have much further impact. But I'm just sharing with you that these books are available, The Fugitive Blacksmith, because
right.
Pembroke was a blacksmith as a young boy when he escaped,
mm-hmm.
and this other historic book, both written during slavery, by someone who went to Yale for 4 years and was not given a degree and had this profound abolitionist career that even stood out in Harriet Beecher Stowe's mind, and of course Harriet Beecher Stowe and Susan B. Anthony, and you know the first wave feminist kind of situation was he was respected by that. So I encourage people to get his books and read them for yourself, see what he said, because it is not about slavery. It is written during slavery, which was a quite different thing, by a pastor who was pastoring at that time and knew the critical issues of the moment from the pulpit.
Wow, that is fascinating. It really is. So Susan B. Anthony had respect for Pembroke, is that what you said?
No, I'm saying that the idea of the first wave feminism being the abolitionists, right? He is in that mix. Harriet Beecher Stowe knew him personally and wrote about him in the book, but she is kind of considered a contemporary ideologically with Susan B. Anthony and other feminists, in that kind of pre-Civil War, post-Civil War nexus.
Okay. Because my understanding of Susan B. Anthony and some of the other first wave of feminists is that they were very racist and they didn't actually want black men to have a vote, and they were saying things like, how can black men be given the vote when white women don't have the vote?
Yes, and so when you begin to deconstruct the period, you'll find that then as now, there were women who were gathered together under one ideological banner, but they were very different. And Harriet Beecher Stowe, in contrast to Susan B. Anthony, was supportive enough to put James Pembroke's name in a book, and that book was a seminal book in the abolitionist movement with regards to gaining sympathy for the oppressed people of that time.
Are you talking about Uncle Tom's Cabin?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
I
don't know. I have such strong feelings about these things because I know that there were white people who used to go down south because they wanted to see slavery for themselves, which I suppose I can understand, really.
Right.
But
yeah,
I find it difficult sometimes to think that people thought it was okay to treat black people the way that they did.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that I'm just saying that the books on record contain this information, and we
Okay, that's really useful to know.
Yeah, that's very, very useful
to know. When you talk about James Pembroke having to sit out, did you say he had to sit outside the classroom?
Correct.
They wouldn't let him in the classroom. You see, now this is what happens today in India with the Dalits.
Yep.
There's a very strong parallel there. I've met someone who actually, and he's only in sort of like his late 30s or possibly early 40s. So this is fairly recent history, that when he was a child growing up, his parents sent him to school, and the school, it was a one-room schoolhouse, and the teacher wouldn't allow him into the school. So he went back home and told his parents, and his parents said, go to the school, sit outside the door and learn. And that's what he did. That's how he got an education, was by sitting outside the door because they would not allow him into the classroom. So, you know, we're talking about stuff that's happening, you know, relatively recently,
well,
very recently, really. And
I haven't spoken
it's quite
to you
possibly
for some
still
time,
happening
but,
now.
Yeah, I've traveled 1,000 miles into Ambedkarite communities in India. And so I'm very familiar with the situation there. And I also teach Buddhism to the Ambedkarite community that is, you know, they're in various countries and so forth. And, yes, I mean, that struck a chord with me, you know. It really struck a deep chord with me because I could relate to that feeling on a personal level, on a familial level.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's heartbreaking. But then you see these human beings who are subjected to that. So he goes through that. Then he winds up finishing the draft of the Constitution of India, right?
Yes.
And
Dr. Ambedkar was very fortunate because his father worked for the British Army. Just to be clear, if any of our listeners don't know who Dr. Ambedkar was, because he is really not well known in the West at all, and he is actually my spiritual hero, and he's a friend of my teacher who founded the True Ratna Buddhist movement, which I'm involved with, which I'm committed to. Dr. Ambedkar was a guy who was born what the Hindus called a Shudra, which is an untouchable, which is the lowest caste. And Hindus are not supposed to touch untouchables because they can be polluted, because untouchables are polluted. And, you know, it's just really horrendous, the oppression that they suffer. They're not allowed to, in Hinduism, they're not allowed to learn to read and write. They're not allowed to touch the scriptures. They're not allowed to own property or money. They're not allowed to ask for anything for themselves. So their oppression is just really horrendous, and many of them are killed every year. Women are attacked every year. The houses are set on fire. All this stuff goes on, and it's justified by saying that God told them to do this, right? This is how it's justified, that it was told to them by one of the gods that this is what they should do. So this is what I call, I mean, I don't personally believe in God, being a Buddhist, but this is what I call blaming God for your own bad behavior, right? That's what I call it. So Dr. Ambedkar is very fortunate because his father worked for the British Army, and so he's able to escape from what's called the hell of caste. He was given a good education. He studied at Columbia in New York, and he also studied at London School of Economics. He was considered to be a genius, basically, very, very bright, and as Lama Rangel just said, he drafted the Indian Constitution, which is considered to be an extremely well-written constitution. But he had situations where there's lots of the films about his life, and he was a personal friend of my teacher. So my teacher was traveling through India. My teacher lived in India for 20 years as a monk. He was called the Venerable Urgyen Sangharakshita, and he had a strong intuition that he needed to be in a certain town by a certain day. So he got there, and he found out that his friend, Dr. Ambedkar, had just died. And so all these people, 300,000 people, had converted to Buddhism because he decided, having studied all the religions, that the only way to escape from what was called the hell of caste was to convert to Buddhism. So that's when Ambedkar converted to Buddhism. And 300,000 people converted with him at the same time. And then within 6 weeks, he passed away because his health was not great. And so there was all these Buddhists who'd never had any Buddhist teachings and never had any teaching. Most of them couldn't even read or write because they weren't allowed to. And so he started working with them. He started working with the new Buddhists, and he started, you know, teaching them the Dharma, teaching them what the Buddha taught. So he is a great, great spiritual hero of mine, Dr. Ambedkar, because he was so committed to his own community. And I think what he did was just extraordinary. Any questions? If you'd like to ask a question, please do. We've got quite a few people on the line. We've got area code 425. Hi. I hope you're still here, still listening.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Have you got any questions?
I am amazed at just the lessons that in hearing the stories and how they can be uplifting to others who may be facing difficulties in terms of equity and race.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we all have that power. We all have the power to uplift others and to inspire others. Some people can only do it on a small scale, and some people can do it on a grand scale. But we all have that power to uplift and inspire others.
Jana, can you hear me? I have a question.
I sure can, yeah. Go
you
for
mentioned-
it.
Yes, well, you know, you mentioned the very commonly taught doctrine of Ham being cursed with dark skin and that being the excuse used that many people accepted for the enslavement of African people.
Yeah, and unfortunately, even, many people still accept it now.
And unfortunately, many black people still believe that. So,
yeah, I know. I find it shocking, but yeah, I think that's true.
People have been told for generations that this is what God says, and you don't question.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's blaming God for your own bad behavior.
Right. But now my question is did knowing about that, did that influence your religious decision to become a Tibetan Lama, you know, seeing the unfairness of that belief that a whole group of people, first of all, there's something wrong with their dark skin, and second of all, that is the curse which they're condemned to enslavement. Did that influence your spiritual decision at all?
Well,
what a great question. Thanks for that.
It's certainly part of my narrative. I mean, I was aware of it, of that thought, that belief in the community. And I found it, you know, distasteful to the point that I just rejected it. My mother was a social psychologist, and you know, so she really taught me how to be in control of my mind, and my mind
Excellent.
Was the key to understanding my identity. So my
Excellent.
Identity was for me to develop taking in all information, not looking away from anything, but then making decisions that were best for me. And so from that point of view, having discussed a little bit about what it was like in the 60s, I was more preoccupied with how do I heal myself from having been through this.
Okay.
And,
because it sounds to me
like
you were well ahead of your time.
Well, you know, not me, my mother. She, like
okay.
I said, she was a social psychologist. She was a supervising psychologist at the women's prison in California.
Right.
But she had many, many friends. When I grew up, I didn't have a father, but I had four mothers.
Okay.
And by that, she had to work sometimes. So her friends would take me to different activities because I was running track and doing football and this and that. And I remember going to these outdoor events and having to sign in, right? And they say, well, you need to have permission from your parent, right? And just whoever took me that day, they would look at them and say, are you the parent? And the my mother's friend, whoever it was, would say, yes. And so,
right,
you know,
right.
you get 4 or 5 years of that. Nobody, everybody's like, who is this kid? What family is he? Who's his brother? Where does he live? Because claim me not as a guardian, but as my parent. And
right,
they delivered a level of love to me in addition to knowledge that helped me.
That's wonderful. That's so beautiful to hear.
All of this, you know, brackish fogging of identity. And so to make a long story short, by the time I was trying to make a decision about faith, I did take into consideration seriously that Christianity had been used to justify slavery. And
yeah.
and that's not a thing for me against Christianity, because there are Christians in the world who have not had that experience.
That's right.
But for me personally, I could not stay in Christianity, which I stayed in for 39 years. I could not stay there because it was the home of the most degrading aspects of my family history
right.
that I could count. And so I began looking, and I found Buddhism in the constellation of all of the other faiths and traditions that I was pursuing. So, but I have been taught to heal thyself, you know. Your
right,
mind,
exactly.
The purpose of your mind is
so
to
it sounds
heal
like, in
you.
A way, your journey had something in common with the journey of Dr. Ambedkar, that you were in a situation which was not helping you to move towards your full potential. So you started looking around, and you chose Buddhism. Is that correct?
He is, as you're saying, he became my personal hero, along with Sangha. And, you know, they were real-life examples in real time, real human beings in the modern era that I could say, I would like to be like that, right? Yeah, so I found his Ambedkar story very personal.
Right. Yes, so do I. I respond to it very personally as well. And it really touches my heart. And the fact that he was also a friend of my teacher, the Venerable Urgyen Sangharakshita, that's just sort of like the icing on the cake for me. Because, you know, he knew they were friends for quite a long time, so he actually knew Dr. Ambedkar for quite a long time.
Yes. You know, when I was in London, when we met, I then went to Birmingham and met with Sangharakshita.
Yeah, I know, I remember. Yeah, you went to see my teacher, yeah.
I couldn't think about going to India without paying homage to him first, you know. And so, you know, I have a long history. I lectured on the relevance of Ambedkar in the African American continuum at Columbia on the 125th anniversary.
Really?
On his 125th anniversary, yes. I was invited and I met many friends because it was a global meeting, and in my lecture, do you know the first thing I said? Because I was new to them, and I knew that in their mind the question was, what does Buddhism have to do with black people? Right?
Exactly, that's one of my questions too. So we can come back to that, yeah, because I definitely want to talk to you about
that. All right. I'm following
And
your
what did
journey.
You tell them?
Oh, I said, you know, I know you're thinking about this question. I'm going to answer it as a first responsibility because you've invited me here. And I said to them, and you have to understand, this room is filled with activists, professors, scholars, intellectuals, artists, all in the Ambedkarite community from all over the world. And I said to them,
really, wow, this is amazing.
I said, because it was a pivotal moment in the consciousness of Ambedkarites and the African-American continuum. I understood that. So I said this. Can anybody in this room, knowing they're all professional speakers and performers, can anybody in this room mention one incident in human history where Buddhists attacked Africa?
Ooh, wow.
And the room was silent.
Mm.
I mean, pin drop silence. And then I said, have you, can anybody in this room point out one incident of Africa attacking Buddhism, knowing what has happened to Africa? Pin drop. Then I said, and I want you to know that India and Africa are as close as New York and New Orleans.
Okay.
I mean, in the history of humanity, there has been much travel between these two continents, but there's never been one single. And if there was, with all those scholars there, somebody would have said something. And when the second question dropped to pin drop silence, I cut the silence and I said, that's the relevance of Buddhism in the African American mind. We can go to Buddhism and not have any residue of what has happened to us on the continent.
Wow.
And I said, you know, go and think about the map of Africa and who speaks Portuguese, who speaks French, who has a Belgian history, who is you know, the Germans, this and that. Think about all of that and then come back to Buddhism, nothing. And if you want to know why I chose Buddhism, it is because of that, because I wanted to find a vehicle that would allow me to free my mind of the baggage and carrying the bricks up the road of trying to find liberation as a human being.
Yeah.
Wow. Regina, we got to take another quick break, but I got another question. Come back. And
we'll be back soon with Lama Rangel after these messages.
With a simple blood test and food plan, Susan Essentials will help your business, your family, and you eliminate toxins and create a step-by-step plan to nourish your mind, body, and spirit. Click here to learn more.
Oh, man, God sent the monthly sun bill today. This sunlight is really expensive, especially during this season. I'll probably have to work overtime to pay it.
Well, you better pay it on time. We don't want the sun to go out and we're sitting up here all day in the dark.
Wouldn't it be terrible if God charged us for sunlight? Well, thank God, the light and heat from the sun is free. So why are we paying such high bills for the energy we use in our homes? Because we don't know how to use solar energy, the free energy from the sun. You can convert your regular home to a solar energy home and save tremendously on your electric bill. Take a look at your electric bill. Wouldn't you like to reduce or possibly even eliminate that cost altogether? Let one of our solar consultants show you how. Call today, 312-849-3456, and schedule a free consultation. That's 312-849-3456.
I'm Beata, your holistic life coach. These days, it's more important than ever to work on your physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health. Are you consciously breathing deeply in stressful moments? Do you have a plan or daily routine to maintain balance in your awesome body? Are you struggling to be disciplined in your eating habits? When you partner with me, I'll help you develop a personalized health plan that works for your particular lifestyle. You can find out more about me at yourholisticlifecoach.com, where you can also review my 3-step protocol to guide you to abundant health. That's yourholisticlifecoach.com, and I'm Viato.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jody Susan with Susan Essentials. I started Susan Essentials in 2015 because of a personal health journey. I was over-medicated and put on 19 different medications. And yes, I reversed all my chronic diseases using plant and energy-based healing. It was amazing. At Susan Essentials, we support both consumers and businesses, and we do that with helping your employees or yourself with a food as medicine mindset. How Susan Essentials supports businesses and consumers is we teach people about a food as medicine mindset. So we support people on how to support their own immune system, how to support their brain health, how to support their emotional well-being. And we do that all with plant and an energy-based healing.
We have an opportunity to transform the whole global society in the next 50 years. 50 years from now, the Earth will be populated by a new generation of adults, many of whom are yet unborn. Our mission is to nurture them in childhood with love, guidance, and protection, and to raise them in healthy, happy families. If we impart values of compassion, generosity, and respect for fellow human beings in the next generation of children, they will create a world where people can live together in peace. This is our goal. Be a part of the transformation. Get your copy of the book, The Female Solution. Go to www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com.
Excellent. This is Jana with the Success Strategy Show. This is part of the Female Solution Global Radio and TV Network. And I'm so happy to be here today speaking with my guest, Lama Rendral, who's one of the few black African-American Tibetan lamas. And you actually met my teacher. When I met my teacher, on the one and only time I met him formally, which was a couple of years ago, a couple of years before he passed away, it was back in 2015, he told me that he remembered meeting you and he enjoyed meeting you, Lama Rendral. And I also know that he has said that Tibetan Buddhism is his favorite type of Buddhism. So tell me, how did you come across Tibetan Buddhism and how did you, what does it mean to be a Tibetan Buddhist? Because you're not from Tibet. You're an African-American, as we've established. And can you explain this so that everyone understands what you mean when you say you're a Tibetan Buddhist?
Thank you for that question. I do want to congratulate you on your many years of work. I know how long you have been working on this issue of solutions. And it was one of the highlights of my life to meet your teacher. And I wanted to express my condolences for his loss.
Thank you.
Because he was a profound human being, a model for all of us. And I know you are his student, and I am very proud to be called upon. And thank you, because, you know, I have students, too, who will hear this. And they've heard me talk about Ambedkar and Sangha Lakshita, but you, as one of his students and personal witness to his comments about me, it means a lot to them. Because they don't want to be involved. They want to be involved with teachers who are the real deal, right?
Exactly.
Not just come lately and slick talk, right? And I don't focus that at any particular person. I just think that, you know, His Holiness has talked about this Dharma light, and Sangha Rakshita's time in India was not Dharma light, trust me.
No, none of his time in England was not Dharma light either. Trust me.
Not at all. So let me go to your question here. It takes many years of training with bona fide teachers and lineage holders in order to become a lama.
Right.
And, for me, I went to nursing school in psychiatry for 2 years, went 4 years for a music degree, 2 years to graduate school. As you may know, I studied with the National Shakespeare Company as an actor, and also I studied at RADA down there on Gower Street, too. And,
I didn't know any of that.
And that was before I started studying with the Tibetans. And then I spent 2 years in forest retreat, and then another 5 years with the abbot of the Dalai Lama's personal monastery, and also he was the abbot of the King of Bhutan's monastery. So it took many years, and a lot of it was undoing Western psychiatry in my mind and replacing it with more profound. I mean, Buddhism's been around for millennia, and the idea
2,500 years
that way.
Yes,
and it's interesting because the word ego does not exist in Buddhism. It exists from the point of view of Westerners' interpretation of Buddhism, but the word itself is Freudian. It is not Buddhistic. And it took many years, and you know, once you get into it, you start to realize, and the Dalai Lama has said this, that the Tibetans didn't invent Buddhism. Buddha was not from Tibet. These, what we call Tibetan Buddhism, are actually the teachings of Nalanda and all the constellation universities of its time that were destroyed. But before they were destroyed, the teachings were taken to Tibet. So really, Tibetan Buddhism is about studying the Nalanda teachings through a second party. And that needs to be, because that takes you back to India, you see. And and so just as the teachings migrated from Nalanda in India to Tibet, so too, as a result of the teachers coming to America, it has migrated to America. But Nalanda teachings are here in America. Now, I, you know, because of my background in psychiatry and my background in performing arts, and I was in the entertainment business, and I've done, you know, many, many groundbreaking shows like the Super Bowl halftime with Michael Jackson and World Cup soccer with Whitney Houston and many, many, many. I toured Japan. That all of that came together as preparation for going into retreat. I did not start in retreat as a new person. And so when I began to understand, and when you're looking at Tibetan Buddhism, you're seeing drums and cymbals and squeaking horns and liturgy and chanting, and you see all this, and incense and costumes, and you're seeing all this richness. And I interpreted that as a music and theater major as Tibetan cultural drama, like opera, Tibetan opera.
Right, right.
And in opera, whether it's French opera or German opera or Italian opera, they're all stories about something, correct? And so I brought
that
knowledge to the Tibetan Buddhist environment, and I began to see the story behind all of the ceremony. And everywhere I looked, it was just redundantly saying the same thing. The mind has a capacity to heal itself just like the body. The mind has the capacity to heal. That, and it was like everywhere I looked, I kept hearing this in the cymbals, in the drums, in the costumes, in the liturgy, in the meditations and the imaginations of deity yoga and all of these things. And so that's how I became a Tibetan Buddhist, was many years of preparation and then an astounding expedited path of learning as a result of my preparation. And then I had really wonderful teachers who were able to give me the essence. You know, when you really get down to Buddhism, it is very, very simple. So simple, people don't believe it.
Right.
This is the difficult. And so it's little things like take your conduct in this world seriously. You only have so much time as a human being here. And you have so much potential and capacity that can be obscured by anger, misinformation, distraction. Mm. If you can get those things out of your way and simply lean into who you are as a human being, you can make a difference in this world. And so this is a very simple idea, but people then, get clouded with these other things I just mentioned, confusion and upset and distraction, and they get concerned about time, they start worrying about death, they worry about money, and, all of these things. But what will be, essentially, what will be your legacy here? Why are you here? Are you here to pay bills? Is that what your life is for? Are you here to serve only the people who are closest to you, who will all fly away from the branch like a bird, one at a time? Is that why you're here? What is your legacy? Is your legacy going to be money left? Is it going to be how much authority you got? And that's why I'm so happy to be with you in this conversation, because we must also consider the possibility that we are here to live, to lead a legacy of peace.
Absolutely.
What more would you want for your community, knowing what you know and what you've been through? Money will not, you cannot buy, and so on and so forth. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, you speak of the worry about death, and that's been so uppermost in the news lately. A lot of fear based on, of course, the time of the pandemic and so forth. But if people are going to be at peace, there has to be a different way to view that. What is the Buddhist way of handling this current global crisis, this current fear about death, this current philosophy of separating yourself from everybody, and this current focus on the fear of getting infected, as opposed to the thought that the body can heal itself? So what is the Buddhist point of view in this time that we're experiencing?
Okay, first, I just want to interject here that if you ask 100 Buddhists the same question, you're likely to get 100 different answers. So I just want to say that up front, yeah?
Hey, that makes sense, yeah. So let me ask, what is your point of view, Lama Rangel, in these times? That way you don't have to answer for everybody. Just your own, based on your Buddhist philosophy and teaching and belief. How are you addressing this situation within yourself to stay at peace?
Well, I've mentioned my family history and, what it was like for me growing up as a young man and all of that. And so my answer comes from healing my personal suffering. And it's interesting to me that a lot of people, when they see the Buddha statue or depicted in an image, they notice the eyes are often closed. But they don't take the time to look a little deeper and realize that those eyes are not just closed, they are looking inward.
Okay.
And that's a nuance of an understanding. But Buddhism it acknowledges the calamity, the cacophony, the existential disruption of the outer world.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes a statement, too, that you have an inner world that is personally yours. And although you may not be able to cease any problem in the world, you can and have power to address your own inner sanctum. And if you can't have peace there, using the facility of your own mind, and it doesn't mean peace on a beautiful day. I mean peace in the middle of calamity and peace in the middle of distress and outrage and upset. And, yes, peace on the deathbed. If you can't die in peace, you have really missed the meaning of life, of living. Because this is your opportunity. No, I'm telling you, Buddhist canon in a nutshell. Okay, I could teach about this for a few months, but in a nutshell,
and you probably have.
When you see that Buddhist eyes, I've been teaching for now, over 20 years, and I've taught on most continents. I have students of every race on every continent, including the Arctic. Okay, and I've talked to translators in many different languages. And so for my work, it is important for me to get down to the essence of what a human being can understand with a small concept, that what they can take from what I'm saying and actually apply to their life. And all of us have the ability to look inside. And there are always places that may be unreachable, okay, that you cannot attend to because the injury can be deep. But there are always places where you can do better in your mind and in your heart. And so to look inward means to excavate like an archaeologist looking for the buried injuries, to excavate them and to bring them to the forefront of your mind, and then apply the time-tested medicine. And what is that medicine? Love for yourself.
Right.
Compassion for yourself. Altruism for yourself. The deep feelings of the emotional capacity of a human being focused by you, on you, just for you. This is what the teaching of Buddhism is. It's not about waiting for some deity up in the sky or some deity under the ground or some deity that lives in the forest or some deity that lives on the water. And I've taught in Oceania, right, in Hawaii and the islands. And their deities are in the ocean, like the shark and the whale and so forth. So human beings put power many places in their imagination. But the Buddhism is unique in that it turns your imagination itself into the power, if I'm being clear.
Oh.
And this is the richness, that the empowerment, the liberation to become an escaped slave from your own self-destruction by misusing your imagination for something other than your own healing, to free yourself, to be liberated. This is what it's all about. This is the essence. And if you, this is the first teacher the abbot taught me. He said, if you don't know how to apply what I just said, that knowledge, to your mind when it gets upset, you do not know Buddhism. It doesn't matter how many books you've read. It doesn't matter how many Lama titles and world praise and people who follow you. It makes no difference if you don't understand how to take that simple understanding and use it in your own mind to heal yourself when your mind gets agitated. And a person who can do that consistently and begin to ease the pain of what it takes to be a human being, that person can teach. That's called a teacher, that person. And not, you don't get certified with it, you don't get a stamp of approval, you don't get a diploma, nothing. You know how I was told that I was a Lama?
Oh, how did that happen?
My teacher called me over to his house. And I didn't like going over his house because when I first met him, he didn't have anything. But in years, he got surrounded by millionaires, and they like to push people around and make him unavailable and all that kind of stuff. I hated going over to his house because I'd known him for years before they ever met him. But he said, come over.
Okay.
And I got there, and there were two other llamas and all these people around who were kind of moving around his house. And he said, come here, sit right there. And I sat next to him. And the people are serving tea and, kind of coming in and out. And at a moment when nobody was in the room but me, him, and these two other lamas, he said, those two lamas right there are abbots of their own monasteries. And then he motioned towards me, and he told them, this man is a lama. That was
wow.
Oh, wow.
That was it.
No, you don't get – there's no trumpets blowing. There's no violin
ceremonies
playing,
and all
there's
that.
There's no ascension. There's nothing. And it's like, you have to understand, the first year I studied with him, he called me Sasquatch for the whole year, which is, Sasquatch is a hairy, like, ape-like monster that is mythological. and then one day I told him, I said, look, you got to stop calling me that because I'm traveling with him, right, and we're going to various places, and he's making me the butt of the Sasquatch joke everywhere we go, with the Chinese Buddhist, mm-hmm. with the Japanese Buddhist. I said, listen, you got to stop calling me that. It's not good for either of us, right, for people to see you saying that about an African-American man. He said, oh, okay, okay. Sorry. And then for the next year, he called me Jesse Jackson because he accused me of trying to be political. No, really. He said, oh, you must be Jesse Jackson. Then for the next year, I was Jesse Jackson. And everybody would have a belly laugh just like you're having.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know what? When he called me Llama, nobody laughed. Because
right.
that's the one thing right. they all wanted. They wanted that. But and he made this statement. He said, "Have you ever noticed I say these things and I humiliate him?" He pointed at me for years, and he never complains. He doesn't complain.
Mm,
he just because he's not here. He's here. He's a student. Right? And so, you know, this teacher's ability to turn you in, and he basically said to me in his own way, I'm calling you Llama, don't take it seriously, because I could call you Sasquatch again. See?
Mm-hmm.
So the title does not make you anything, which is very different than our Western notion, I have a BA, I have an MA, I have a PhD, look at
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, the title doesn't make you anything. It is you and your conduct and your actions in the world that it will define what that word means when it is applied to you.
That's right.
And
wow.
So, you know, this I'm still answering your question. How did I become a Tibetan Llama? And this was after all of that education prior to two years, a little bit more of forest retreat, and then 5 years with him. And then finally he said that. And that's, you know, a little insight into what it is. And I leave you with this one statement. If you don't know how to use your mind to recover your dignity from what has happened to you, when your mind starts to go awry, you do not understand Buddhism mm-hmm. yet. Not yet.
Okay. But this is what I find when you're talking to your teacher. He can say anything he wants to say, or she can. Say anything she wants to say, and you just accept it. I mean, I consider three people to be my teachers. One of them is Subhuti, he's the only one that's still alive, and he was Sangharakshita's right-hand man for many years. Very, very
mm-hmm.
dear friend of mine. He can say anything
mm-hmm.
he wants to me, right? And I just smile and say, okay, Subhuti, because I know he's coming from a place of total love. I trust him so much. He can get away with stuff which I wouldn't allow anybody else to get away with, because I know that he doesn't mean me any harm. He's totally innocent in that kind of way. And he's just coming from love, and I know that. He doesn't mean anybody any harm, and I know that, and it's so clear when I talk to him.
Wow.
The first time I met him, I wasn't even a Buddhist yet, and I came in late. I didn't know who he was, but I could see his aura, and I'm not normally an aura reader, but I could see his aura, and his aura was bedecked with jewels, diamonds and gold and silver, and I just knew he was different from anybody I'd ever met before.
Mm. Wow, that's
and,
powerful.
You know, he could call me Sasquatch, he could call me anything, and I would just smile and say, okay, Subhuti, because I love him so much and I trust him so much, you know?
Powerful. Yeah, we got to take one last break. And when we come back, I have another question. I saw something about, I don't know if it might be, you know, the ancestor of Llama Rangel, but I'll find that when we come back. And, of course, if you're listening online, want to join this conversation, give us a call, 515-605-9325, and press 1. If you want to talk to the host, we're, of course, our host today, live from London, Jhana Books, and her guest is Llama Rangel. You're listening to and watching the Female Solution Global Radio TV show, Success Strategies, Jhana in Conversation with Llama Rangel. We'll be right back after this last break, so stay with us.
Hey, Have you ever dreamed of going to exotic places, meeting fascinating people, enjoying uplifting music, and spending nights in a luxurious hotel? Do you look forward to a relaxing vacation where you can walk along the beach or sit in a quiet park and enjoy the sunset or sunrise? Whether you're flying around the world or driving across the country, we will share travel tips that will help you stay safe while you enjoy the journey. Join me every third Saturday of the month, 12 noon to 2 p.m. Central Standard Time, and move around with Deborah here on the Female Solutions Show. Call in and comment 515-605-9325 and press 1 to speak.
What happens when a group of people are kidnapped from their homes, smuggled away in chains, and held captive in a foreign land where they are tortured, raped, and forced to perform hard labor by the lash of a whip and under the constant threat of death? Slavery, the African-American psychic trauma. What happened to the doctors, writers, scientists, builders, educators, and spiritual leaders from Africa's golden age? Who did they really capture and sell into slavery? Are all African Americans suffering from psychic trauma because of a conspiracy to hide their true identities? Do you have psychic trauma? Take the test on page 22 of the book and see. Order it online today at www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com. And get your personally autographed copy of the book, Slavery, the African American Psychic Trauma.
Is Monday morning a struggle to get out of bed into the swing of things? Well, don't worry, you are not alone. Join us for thought-provoking, stimulating, and mindful conversations on Higher Learning with Zelda Speaks for your Monday morning mindfulness session on Blog Talk Radio, The Female Solution, Mondays, 7:30 until 9 a.m. Be sure and send your ideas, thoughts, comments, and suggestions. Also, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, visit ZeldaSpeaks.com and send us your info. We'd love to have you. Experience mindfulness moments with the mindfulness / stress relief coach, Zelda Speaks. And thanks for sharing the mindfulness moment tip of the day. Stay on purpose, stay empowered, and stay tuned to your next session of Mindfulness on Higher Learning with Zelda Speaks. Make it a mindful day. And thanks for listening.
We're back. This is Jana. Welcome back to the Success Strategies Show. I'm chatting with my guest today, Lama Rangel, who's one of the few black African-American Tibetan lamas. And we've been talking a bit about Buddhism and the way that Buddhism can change lives. Because, you know, I'm a Buddhist, so I enjoy talking to another Buddhist about the same thing, even though, as I said earlier, if you ask 100 different Buddhists the same question, you're likely to get 100 different answers about most things, not everything, but about most things. And I just wanted to ask a couple questions about your film. The film is called Festival Cancelled Due to Heavy Rain, and it's available on YouTube, and I strongly advise you to watch it. It's very powerful. It's very short, but it's very powerful and also very beautiful. And I was wondering, Lama Rangel, if you could tell us a little bit about what made you decide to make a pilgrimage to Cambodia and also what inspired you to make your film, Festival Cancelled Due to Heavy Rain.
Thank you for that question. When I was in retreat, in forest retreat, and I was kind of shedding my conventional, contemporary, modernistic identity for deeper excavation of Buddhism, I asked the Tibetans, where's the Africa in this? Which is, you know, as African American. And they said there is none. And, of course, in my own research, even before I got there, I had seen these Africanized Buddhas in Angkor Wat in Cambodia. So, you know, I was there to study in retreat, so I just put a picture of one of the images of the face on my altar in my cabin. I lived in a cabin that had no heat or running water. In the forest for 2 years. But I had an altar.
Wow.
I put this picture. And it kind of sustained me because I was like, okay, there's no African in this. There's no African in this. I kept telling myself, but I said, but this picture right here says something else. And then after I got out and retreated, studying with the Kempo and so forth, my teacher, then I had a chance to go to Thailand. And Thailand is only a short flight to Cambodia.
Okay.
And so I thought, let me go see, and I say in the film, I wanted to go to see if it's really true. Are there actually statues of Buddhas? The nose is not broken off. They're not chipped. They're not damaged by some kind of conquering force. Is it really true? I said to myself, I just need to see it. I just need to see it one time in my life. You know, because so many times we've seen broken images of ourselves in the world. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, all the time.
And so I said,
but people
and then
change.
I said, once I see it, I'm going to hold it in my mind, and then I'm going to shatter that image. Because it's not about holding on to it, right? It's about liberation, but I just want to see it. And that was the motivation. And then someone encouraged me to take a camera, and I was like, okay. And the rest is history. But, you know, also, and the finishing touches of becoming a lama, okay, it is necessary. A lot of people don't know. It's not required, but it's really helpful if you can demonstrate a certain kind of mastery in an art. Like a lot of lamas, they're either scholars, they are painters, they are ritualists, they have many different arts, and they commerge all of this into what we see as Tibetan Buddhism. But to be a lama, really, you must demonstrate a certain level of skill. So I said, let me shoot this, let me edit it, let me write the music for it, let me score it, and this will be, it was like a class project. I never meant for it to be sold or anything. It's
right.
That was part of me finishing the lamaistic training by doing something specifically Buddhist that would be a contribution to the archive, right? Because there is no film like that, or wasn't at that time, seeing Cambodia through a black man's, black people's eyes. You know, these are Buddhists from Africa. I'm not going to play the game of, oh, are they or are they not? I'm not. To me, they are. When
right,
a Chinese
exactly,
person
yeah.
sees a Buddha that's Chinese, they don't go, is that really a Chinese person? You know, or Vietnamese.
That's right.
Or,
that's right. But they never had to. As you said, the way that we tend to be represented is not necessarily a positive reflection of who we are.
Yeah. And it was something that a Christian would never do. So
true,
I had all of these kinds of ideas in my mind, and plus there were, I thought about all of the Buddhists who wouldn't be going to retreat and wouldn't be challenged by this idea that there's no Africa, and who would see these images and wonder, what is that, right? And for their edification, again, not for commercial purposes, I did this film with the help of others.
Yeah, it is a really beautiful film, and it's very hard-hitting because it talks about what was going on in the hood with young black men being hunted by the police, and also young black men being sent to fight in Vietnam. And, you know, as you know from your own personal experience, some of them never came back. Some of them only came back in body bags. Some of them left parts of themselves in Vietnam. And they went to Vietnam, you know, they're supposed to be fighting to defend our country, but when they got there, they found out there was something completely different going on.
Yeah.
And that's why with the anti-war demonstrations, there were also, there were veterans, Vietnam veterans, and even people on active service who took part in the anti-war demonstrations. And they were black, they were white, they were, you know, different backgrounds. But they'd been to Vietnam, they'd been on the front line, and they'd seen what was going on. And at the same time, people like you were on the front line in the hood.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question.
Oh, yeah, go for it. Go for it.
I recall that movie, The Killing Fields. That was about what happened in Cambodia, right? With the,
awful.
Millions of tons of explosive dropped on the small Buddhist country of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. I said, no, my daughter, she visited Cambodia, and she was, you know, talking about how they, I guess they have kind of like different memorials of that time when that happened, and of course the horror of it, so that they would remember not to ever do that again. But she said that there were, you could see where there's a generation of people that was traumatized by that, like the generation that's alive now that lived through that. So with one of the things, I guess, in your film, I'm sure addresses a lot of the things that, you know, you experienced. What do you see as maybe a correlation between what happens in war-torn countries and what many people experience in the hood? Is there still same kind of levels of post-traumatic stress disorder? How do you compare those two experiences?
Well, there's a hidden meaning in the title. Festival was canceled due to heavy rain. See, the Cambodian people did not want to enter the war. The Vietnamese came across the lines, and they set up camp in Cambodia against the king's permission. And the Americans held that against Cambodia and said, look, if the enemy's there, we're going to bomb. And the order from the president, Nixon, was bomb them back to the Stone Age, which they did.
Oh.
And at the same time, he was lying about it and saying, no, we're not bombing Cambodia. And it's so shocking.
When you think about the Cambodian people and the joy and the festiveness of the people, right, that's their festival. It's their human right. But unfortunately, they had a heavy rain, and that heavy rain was millions of tons of bombs.
That was the rain.
They were having a they have a human right to the festival of being their indigenous self, but they were subjected to a heavy rain. Understand?
Now
when you got your brothers and your sisters in the hood, right? Hey, we want to live too, but we
That's
have
right.
been through centuries of heavy rain. You see what I'm saying?
Woo!
In the same way, we have been devastated. And so the heavy rain for us is all of these conditions that we find ourselves in, that we found our parents in, that are throughout our history on this continent. And so there's a parallel. It's a hidden understanding of that title, but that title says it all. And so for me, when I saw that kind of suffering, I took it very personally. This represents the destruction of me. That people call the Vietnam War, problems of being a black man and seeing my sisters go down too, you know, just being black in America, that it was that totality that inspired me to, because I had to find hope again. I had to resurrect hope. And so I try to leave the film in a hopeful idea. We don't have to all be Buddhist, but we can learn something from Buddhism. If nothing, that we have a power to resurrect our own dignity and our own personal healthy state of mind. And so that was how the parallel played out, and I put it in the title.
So if the idea with Buddhism then, it doesn't matter what other people do. Like, other people don't have to apologize. Other people don't have to admit that they did wrong. Other people don't have to, you know, make you feel better or acknowledge your worth. It has to come from within you to repair the damage to your own mind. Is that pretty much?
And we all have that power. We all have that ability as humans. That's one of the glorious things about being human. That's what the Buddha taught, is that we are able to be aware of our minds. We're able to be self-aware. I mean, there's no such thing as self. So it's hard for me to come up with the right terminology. But if I say self-aware, then we understand what that means, yeah?
Right. So this is a common question. Yes, we do have a right to hold the world accountable for its conduct. But here's the more principled question that we all need to ask ourselves. If we cannot look inside ourselves and change ourselves for the better, who are we to expect anybody else to do that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
and what my teacher taught, which I very much agree with, is that when we look within and when we address our own patterns of behavior, patterns of thought, patterns of emotion, as we do that, we are already influencing those around us. Right, because I think a lot of times we want to bring about change. We point to somebody else. They have to change, right? They have to change their behavior. Or as you just said, Naima, they have to apologize or something. But what my teacher taught and what I really believe is that when we look within and when we work on ourselves, then that sort of automatically spills out. It spills out over the surrounding areas, and it affects other people and animals. He also said that in Buddhist countries, wild animals are less wild than they are in other places. So I find that quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I got one more quick question for your guest also.
Yeah, go for it.
In a little history on Pembroke, it said Pembroke is one of the oldest black rural townships. It was founded by a runaway slave named Pap Tedder before the Emancipation Proclamation. Folk history tells us that he and his family of 18 children escaped from North Carolina around 1861. Does that sound like
18 children?
Pap Tedder?
Well, 1861 is late. You know, Pembroke was I think he ran away from slavery around 1820 or so. So, I mean, he had many sisters and brothers, and if you give it time, you know, and he did move throughout the country. So I have no doubt that there is a spread. I haven't done that research, but what you will find in the research about Pembroke is that people who are related to him tended to hold the family name. So it's more likely than not, if you meet a black person whose last name is Pembroke, they are somehow on the tree of the family lineage. But it's not clear how that connection is. But I'd like to go back to
I'm just wondering, how is it possible? How is it even possible to escape with 18 children? I mean, that's extraordinary. And we've got a guest on the line. I'm sorry to cut you off, Lama Ranger, but I just want to know, who is our guest, area code 312?
Oh, that's my number. Yeah, I had to switch numbers.
Oh, that's your number, sorry. Area code 863, are you still with us? Okay, if you want to ask a question to Lama Rendro, you've got 11 minutes, so, you know, we're very, very happy to hear from you if you'd like to ask another question. But, yeah, wow, how can you escape with 18 children? That's extraordinary. That's extraordinary. Well, what do you think? What do you think is extraordinary?
They all live. Same time. Maybe
the punishment for one family member running away was the entire family would be sold into slavery. And so you had this, we were from the Maryland area, but when James Pembroke escaped, of course, family members were sold to the South.
Right.
And so there was spread in that kind of way. And then over time, you know, we don't know whether these large families come from by choice or
yes,
by
sure,
expectation with regards to providing labor. Again, I identify with that family history, like we stand on the earth. But my Buddhist idea, my Buddhist mind focused on the sky, the limitless, vast nature of the sky. And it's important to know your family history, but also, you know, you got to be careful because there can be a lot of emotions tied up in that. And,
sure,
you know, I would like to say one other thing, and that is just to make, I've been talking to people about, especially Buddhists, be careful of being provincialized, because sometimes we get,
okay.
You know, I go through various communities. Like I spent a lot of time in Oakland, and they have a specific idea about Buddhism, which is very different than Chicago, where I've also been, and very different than New Orleans, where I've also taught. And I've taught in Memphis at the Lorraine
Hotel.
Are you talking about
black communities or just in general? Because Oakland is primarily black, is
both,
it not?
Both. And but then what I'm saying is once you take that idea and you go to, say, Thailand, it doesn't even fit.
Right.
And you go to Cambodia,
right.
The Cambodians and the Thais have very different ideas. And in India, there are many ideas about Buddha, and Amsterdam, and, you know, London, and Stockholm, and all these places. And so the real notion of having a fulfilled idea of Buddhism comes from the engagement in its the vastness of its differential. It is so different,
okay.
So many places, and yet uniformly honest and true in all of these places that you begin to get the real feeling. It's interesting to be in the temples in Cambodia, in the mosquitoes and the sweltering heat, squeezed between rocks, trying to look at an image, right? You get a certain kind of Buddhism, and you feel the centuries of people who have been in this place, which you cannot get in America, right? So I encourage, you know, let's be provincial because it's important, but also understand that Buddhism is extremely vast, and there is applicability everywhere. It is unlimited, its application. So we have to be careful, you know, as we formulate our minds about Buddhism, that we also acknowledge where we have been, where we have not been, and try to gather as much information and experience as possible outside of our comfort and knowledge zones about Buddhism so that we can be greater informed. So I wanted to make sure that I got that in, because Buddhism is a living tradition, and it's like when I was in Cambodia, I saw many artesian springs. The water just come right out the ground, no plumbing, nothing. It's just a pond, and it would just spurt up all over the place. And all those different places, it was still water, but some of it flowed like a river. Some of it sat still like a pond. Some of it had been in a tank, and the tank had been filled since the 11th century,
right?
So, you know, our minds and our ability to express and countenance Buddhism at the global level is very important to the understanding of its application as a peace model at the global level, which I think this show is really about. And I really appreciate from the depths of my heart the invitation to come and share a few minutes with you.
Oh, it's so lovely. It's so lovely. It's been lovely having you on and hearing your reflections, and there's so much more. We must have you on again because there's so many more questions I want to ask you now. The more you talk, the more I want to ask you questions. But can you just give us a few final words, please, about what do you think Buddhism teaches us about peace and nonviolence? And, you know, we've had this ongoing theme, how can we create a peaceful world? Can you speak to that a minute?
I think that a peaceful world is an amalgam of constituent parts, each part being a peaceful person. And I think that it's important for us each to do our role. And that doesn't necessarily mean Buddhism. It just means that we must find a way to be peaceful, because the fact is, the truth is, we outnumber the violent ones. They just have a lot of power, right?
Right.
And so how we coordinate ourselves in mass at a global level will make a difference. And if that opportunity comes, then I think that the way to a peaceful world is for each of us to have already done our part to become a peaceful person. Because we're in expedited time now. There's not a lot of time left. Okay, there's no time to be playing around. The numbers coming out of India alone, 3.5 million people dead.
Wow, okay? That's extraordinary.
And you know, me, you, our loved ones, anybody could be next. So this
is
the time. And if not us, who? We have all of the benefits of having lived during a time when the pandemic was not happening. We need to bring those resources to bear. And it's not so much for Buddhism, it's not so much that you will die. The real question is, how did you live? What did you understand? You know, don't look for empowerment outside until you know how to achieve it inside.
Right.
These kinds of questions, you know, and amalgamated within the sense of humanity can make a difference.
Okay. That's so inspiring. This is Jana with the Success Strategy Show on the Female Solution Network. Thank you very much for my guest, Lama Rangel. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and sharing your so much knowledge, knowledge about the future, knowledge about the past, where we are now. I really appreciate you joining us and hope you can join us again at some point. And also, many thanks to my executive producer, Naima Latif, and all of our callers. Thank you so much. We always love hearing from you. Goodbye until next month, and do check out Lama Rangel's film, Festival Cancelled Due to Heavy Rain, which is available on YouTube. It's only a short film, but yeah, I think you'll enjoy it. Have a good month, and this is Jana for Success Strategies. We'll be back again next month.
Come to the end of our show today, but you can hear every show in the archives at www.blogtalkradio.com/the-female-solution. You can also hear today's show on the Female Solution Facebook page. Go to www.facebook.com/the-female-solution. Leave your comments about today's show. You can always reach me on my website at www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com. Watch our TV shows, listen to our radio shows, order our books, and be sure to get your copy of the book, The Female Solution. On behalf of our team of radio hosts, I'd like to thank all of you who participated in today's discussion. And to our global family listening from all around the world, we say thank you. To our family in China, Sheshe. India, Zanyaba. Japan, Arigato. Korea, Kamsamida. Russia, Spasiba. Germany, Danke. Poland, Dziękuję. France, Merci. Spain, gracias. Italy, grazie. Egypt, shukran. Ghana, medasi. Nigeria, eshe. South Africa, ngiyabonga. Senegal, jeret. Kenya, asante. Israel, toda. Pakistan, shukriya. Afghanistan, Tashakur, Saudi Arabia, Shukran. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Thank you, and may peace be upon you and the mercy of God and God's blessings.